chapter of the book of James. A few minutes we'll be looking at about the first half of James chapter 5. While you're turning, you've been looking at a photograph that's unrelated to this morning's lesson, but has borne on material we've been studying, particularly in the book of Judges, and then now in 1 Samuel as well. That in the distance, that hillside, is the location of Shiloh, where apparently for about 300 years, the tabernacle, which they had first built in the book of Exodus and Leviticus, you read about that while Moses was in the wilderness with the Jews having escaped Egypt. That tabernacle, when they came into the promised land, would spend most of its time before finally settling in Jerusalem, there on that hillside in the distance in the area that is known as Shiloh. About 300 years, as a matter of fact, in that particular location. Get this turn here. I've been warning for the last 2 weeks that we've been studying material, 3 weeks, I guess, the material in James chapter 4 and in the early going of this fifth chapter, which is really very difficult material from the standpoint that there are a lot of problems and criticisms that the saints have at that time and that James has for them in the various failures that they have manifested here in their service before him. We've been covering that material now, as I say, for actually about 3 weeks, and so going to be looking at the last part of this grimmer section, you know, in the book of James here this morning. Before we do, though, I wanted to mention or ask, I can count how many times, that probably in the Bible studies, in your various places that you've attended, sermons that you've heard, you have heard teachers refer to the importance of context. How many times have you heard the word context since you started studying the Bible? And for good reason. If we, here's an expression you've heard, lift something out of context or abuse something in its context, it means that we have taken a statement, isolated it, and thereby, you know, misused and abused it, but what is the biggest problem? It's just misunderstood the intention of the writer. Everything that a Bible writer says, precisely the same with everything that you read in a newspaper or magazine or hear on the radio or see on your television or face-to-face conversations with friends, enemies, and everybody in between, you know, is everything of regarding understanding revolves around the subject matter we're discussing, the context that the statement was made in. If we are to have communication, co-understandings, then it's critically important. Any form of interaction between human beings, that we study the thing in its context. If not, we're likely to make terrible mistakes. Particularly with the book of James this morning, I would like to spend an unusually large amount of time thinking about the context of this book. And when I say context, I do not mean just, as important as it is, the verses before and the verses that follow. Context can be, usually is, something larger than that as well. The place where the book is written or the people to whom the book is written, the circumstances that they are experiencing. And often enough, in the writings of the New Testament, the prophetic predictions of what the people will be facing, instructions that are given because of a context that perhaps exists right now, but may be getting worse or better, or perhaps preparing them for a new societal context that they're not even currently experiencing. So particularly with this book of James, apparently written by the Lord's half-brother, not sure about the date, but perhaps as early as the 50s, likely sometime in the 60s, written by a man who is spending his lifetime of service to the Lord in the city of Jerusalem, but being written to Jews who have become Christians and who have been scattered throughout the Roman Empire. This great Christian leader is moved by the Holy Spirit to write 5 chapters to prepare them, particularly, for a context that they are going to be seeing worsen and for which they must be very, very well prepared. this context, this broader context, is something that Jesus had been discussing while he was still on the earth. John chapter 16 and verse 33, he says, "These things I have spoken to you so that in me you may have peace. In the world you have tribulation, but take courage. I've overcome the world." Jesus wanted his disciples to understand that they should expect tribulation. That is, conflict and problems and opposition and difficulties that flow from their living in the biggest context possible, the world, being in a fleshly, physical, material world, and facing the problems that come with that as we are trying to prove ourselves faithful in that largest of contexts so that we can then enter into an eternity into an altogether different context, which will be nothing but peace and will be free from all tribulation, and which will give us then, you know, an eternity of freedom from the problems that Jesus was preparing them for. Later in Jesus' teaching and in the last week of his life, he said this in Matthew 24, verses 9 and 10. "They will deliver you," the apostles, the men he's speaking to tribulation. "And they will kill you." We know that almost every one of the apostles is known to have been murdered at the hands of the enemies of Jesus Christ. "You will be hated by all nations because of my name." Well, it's going to take decades to get that message out into all the nations. Jesus is wanting these men to understand that as their succeeding years, you know, are passing, this tribulation is going to be spreading not just from their immediate context in Israel, but beyond that, as the gospel moves out into the rest of the Roman Empire. He says, "At that time, many will fall away." So he will have started out serving the Lord and then turn from it, "and will betray one another and hate one another." That's the context of tribulation. A few verses later, he says, "There will be a great tribulation, such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will. Unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short." And Jesus is warning them about circumstances that they're going to see, which will be horrible. They'll be temporary. Life will be endangered, but they will come to an end. For the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Note in Romans now, some years later, Jesus has been crucified. He's risen from the dead. He spent 40 days, proving that he was back from the dead. He returned to heaven from whence he would reign and does to this day. But Paul was moved by the Spirit to tell Roman Christians, way off over in Italy now, far removed from the context of Israel and its problems. He says to them, "Who will separate us from the love of Christ? Will tribulation, or distress, or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or peril, or sword, just as it is written. For your sake," should be an R there, "for your sake, we are being put to death all day long. We were considered as sheep to be slaughtered. But in all these things, we overwhelmingly conquer through him who loved us." Brethren, that's a pretty foreboding list there. Tribulation, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, sword, the loss of all comforts in life and the threat to any material possessions you've had and even to life itself. It's a long and foreboding list. Not something anybody would want willingly to find in their lives. But it is the context of the Roman letter. It's the preparation for those people who call themselves Christians in Italy. Later in Romans chapter 12, Paul says, "Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Give preference to one another in honor, not lagging behind in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, persevering in tribulation, devoted to prayer, contributing to the needs of the saints, practicing hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse." You know what he means? Do not curse those evil people for the difficulties they bring upon you. Do not be cursing the evil and wicked people that are out there in the planet. Bless the ones who are actively, directly, personally persecuting you. And then rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Brethren, they needed to know that there would be tribulation. They would need to persevere in that tribulation, how to behave during that tribulation. They would need to practice hospitality because some would be traveling and some would be losing their homes and needing, you know, some sort of shelter. You're going to be persecuted and you need to be careful about how you speak of the people who do that. And you need to be prepared to weep with those who are suffering these terrible losses. And Paul's not interested with just the Romans, as if they would have a local problem over there. That's Italy. This is Macedonia. When he says in the First Thessalonian letter, and now one of the contenders, by the way, for first book ever written in the New Testament, it's probably 52 A.D., likely written a couple of years at least before the letter that we're reading now, James. He says to the Thessalonians now, far removed from Rome and Israel, you also became imitators of us and of the Lord, having received the word in much tribulation with the joy of the Holy Spirit, so that you became an example to all the believers in Macedonia and in Achaia. Now, brethren, tribulation is bad enough. Much tribulation is clearly worse. You know, this is not something that I would wish upon anyone. But as a matter of fact, brethren, tribulation is an inherent part of the whole New Testament's context, of the Roman Empire's context, of the saints' context, wherever they were when these books are being written. Revelation's last book in the New Testament, and in the first chapter, verse 9, I, John, your brother and fellow partaker in the what? In the tribulation and kingdom and perseverance which are in Jesus, was on the island called Patmos because of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. When he wrote that book to those seven churches in Asia, which is not Palestine, which is not Macedonia, which is not Italy, when he wrote to now these seven churches in Asia, he said he was a partaker in three things. And brethren, I'd like for you to look at that structure there in the sentence. Doesn't it read to you like this trilogy is just a part of the Christian context? I am a partaker in the tribulation, the kingdom, and the perseverance, which are in Jesus. He didn't say which are in Italy, as if it was not somewhere else, which are in Palestine, Macedonia. He's saying a tribulation that's in Jesus, a kingdom that's in Jesus, a perseverance that's in Jesus. Because you are in Jesus, it is necessary, it is inherent, it is expected, and it's constantly mentioned throughout the books of the New Testament. If you're in Jesus, there'll be tribulation, there'll be the kingdom, and there'll be perseverance. And as a matter of fact, he's been banished from the mainland to a tiny, little, and fairly desolate island, though it has a city on it called Patmos, as a matter of fact, island and city. And he is suffering the loss of all possessions, all friends, and all brothers and sisters in Christ, exiled offshore to a tiny, little, penal colony that is called Patmos. Something to think about. In the next chapter, he says to one of those churches in particular, others have the same problem, to the angel of the church in Smyrna, write, the first and the last who was dead and has come to life says this, I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. And the blasphemy by those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan, do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison so that you will be tested and you'll have tribulation for 10 days. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. Brethren, that's a lot of context, isn't it, for your New Testament? That's a lot of context for the first Christians. And these things are recorded in Bible books, 27 of them, that have been preserved for us, we call the New Testament, 2,000 years. So that in our world's context, we will be equally prepared for stuff like this. Now, a little bit small print and crowded there, I grant, but from Josephus' book, which is called Wars of the Jews, a Pharisee who was also a general who fought the Romans, starting in 66 A.D., which would be probably just after the book of James was written, but in the very same time frame, very, very close, matter of just a few years, at James' time, while he is apparently still living. In the Wars of the Jews, book 2, in chapter 18, and in the first 8 lines, Josephus, this uninspired non-Christian who lived in the same days that the New Testament books were being written, said this: the people of Caesarea had slain the Jews among them, insomuch that in 1 hour's time, above 20,000 Jews were killed, and all Caesarea was emptied of its Jewish inhabitants. They laid waste the villages of the Syrians, far to the north, Philadelphia, named in the book of Romans in Asia, Sebenitis, Gerasa, which is over in modern-day Jordan, Pella, Scythopolis, Gadara, Hippos, various cities that are in the general area of Palestine, falling upon Gaulonitis, France. Some cities they destroyed, some they set on fire, then went to Cadassa, belonging to the Tyrians, outside the Promised Land, but up to the north on the coast, modern Lebanon today, Ptolemais, to Gaba, nor was either Samaria or Ashkelon, back in the area of Palestine, able to oppose the violence with which they were attacked. And when they had burnt these to the ground, they entirely demolished Anthedon and Gaza, yes, that Gaza that you have to this day. Many also the villages that were about every one of those cities were plundered, and immense slaughter was made of the men who were caught in them. What is this uninspired historian telling us about the years that James lived in and the people, Jews, who had become Christians throughout this Roman Empire, many cities of which are now mentioned as being rendered devoid of the Jews? Brethren, do you suppose that these Romans were going along and saying, well, hey, I see you're a Jew. Are you a Christian? And if you are, we'll let you off, because we're only upset with Jews who are not Christians. No, brethren, they were indiscriminate, the Romans, in their persecution of the Jews, who James is writing to that have become Christians and will be caught up in this horror that James has prepared them for throughout the Roman Empire into which they have been scattered. So when I say context, sure, I mean chapter 4 and the verses that follow those we'll be looking at here in just a moment. But I also mean, brethren, in the whole book of James, and the whole New Testament, and the whole Roman Empire. So remember that this theme of suffering and tribulation is in the very first verses of the book, and we are now finding them at the end. In James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4, consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its perfect result, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. These are the same ideas that we found Paul preparing all those things for. Skip down to verse 11 in this first chapter. The sun rises with a scorching wind and withers the grass, and its flower falls off, and the beauty of its appearance is destroyed. So too, the rich man in the midst of his pursuits will fade away. The next verse, blessed is a man who perseveres under trial. For once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. He's warning them, if you're rich, expect to lose it all. Expect serious problems and look to the crown of life. That's the first chapter in the early going. Turn a few pages now to the last chapter and entering into the verses that we have to consider here this morning. Come now, you rich, just mentioned back in the first chapter, weep and howl for the miseries which are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted. Your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have rusted. Their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you. And the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. You'll note that's not Sabbath, it's Sabaoth, it's a different word. And it just means hosts, multitudes, manys. It always refers to a great and massive crowd. It's the word you use for stars. It's the word you use for grains of sand on the beach. It's the word you use for the descendants of Abraham. It's the word we would use for Christians scattered throughout the empire. It's the use of angels. It's Sabaoth. He is the Lord of everybody. He is the Lord of everything. And it's reached his ears. Excuse me. That these sins and cruelties are being perpetrated. He says in 5, you have lived luxuriously on the earth, led a life of wanton pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. Skip to verse 8. You too be patient, strengthen your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not complain, brethren, against one another, that you yourselves may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing right at the door. But what is he saying? He's saying you're living in a world of tribulation. You're facing a bunch of problems. Now, we had this discussion last week, so I'm just going to touch on it this morning. Many suggest that in a rhetorical manner, he is not addressing Christians themselves, but the society at large. Hence all this iniquity and the withholding of wages, and the people crying out in this view would be the saints themselves who are not guilty of any of the crimes that are being mentioned here, or they would say, in the early verses of chapter 4, as we've studied in the last 2 weeks. In both cases, they would distance the saints from being the perpetrators of these things. I just want you to know, brethren, that while that certainly could be the case, it may be the case, the words would allow that to be the case, it is not necessarily the case or exclusively the case. And Christians were misbehaving back then, as Christians have misbehaved throughout the centuries and even misbehaved to this day. So I'm not so sure I don't run with that. I just leave the door open to understand that this material is true for anybody that behaves like this. And it's trying to promote the righteousness that frequently saints are criticized for lacking, throughout the New Testament. But with all that said, brethren, all I'm wanting to do now, there'll be no more slides, is to look at this context for just about 2 or 3 minutes. Because it's not hard to understand. But in its context, it is profoundly more enlightening and powerful and useful if we understand the world they were living in and that we are living in and that they were facing and that we are facing. Because if anything is known about history, brethren, is it linear or is it round? It's round, isn't it? Those who are unfamiliar with history are doomed to repeat it, we say. We've seen the cycle in the book of Judges that we've been studying on Wednesday nights. What goes around comes around in the sense of you reap what you sow. But brother, what goes around comes around in history too. Seen it all before, see it all again. Brethren, do you know what one of the really big problems was that Benjamin Franklin, yes, that one who gave me these glasses, that one was dealing with as a politician in the 1700s in the United States of America? It was Muslim terrorism. Did you know that? Letter after letter that he wrote dealing with Muslim piracy and murder that they were dealing with all those hundreds of years ago. What goes around comes around. Now, brethren, what have we been living in the United States for these last, 100 years? Now, we've seen world wars, we've seen depression, we've seen, a lot of things. Been up, been down. By and large, though, in more recent history, in your lifetime, at home at least, things have been what? Pretty cool. Really have. Problems that were going on everywhere else, we didn't have to deal with. And then what happened on September 11th of 2001? What happened to France the day before yesterday that all the commentators are saying is just as likely to happen in the United States as it is there? Okay? Tribulation, distress, all kinds of problems from those who hate you as Christians or just hate you as Americans, from problems and evil rich people who don't handle banking investments properly and destroy your investments, as a result. Tribulation and distress, that is the context, brethren, of every material life. James is preparing the Jews for what was thought to be at the time the probable collapse of the entire Roman Empire. Didn't happen, but in 66, when Nero committed, ordered Palestine to be invaded, and then in 68, when he killed himself, the Roman Empire, brethren, just erupted in flames everywhere. And it wasn't just the Jews who were being persecuted, and Christians specifically as well, but everybody everywhere was having problems. And James is saying, look, tribulation and the kingdom and perseverance that John mentioned on Patmos is a part of being a Christian. And if you've been escaping it so far, it's coming round. And you need to be ready for terrible suffering and problems. So with that context, brethren, let's just read through James 5, these first verses again. Come now, you rich, which by their standards of that day includes every soul that is here, whether you're receiving government aid or not, whether you think you're in a nice home or not, whether you're homeless or you're jobless or not, the circumstances we live in would be considered vastly wealthy by their standards then. Weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Riches have rotted, garments have become moth-eaten, gold and silver rusted. The rust will be a witness against you and consume your flesh like fire. It's in the last days you've stored up your treasure. A couple of ways to understand that last days. I'm not going to get into that today. It's not our purpose, for theological discussion of the last days. Just to understand, these things mattered to them then. They matter as well to us now. Behold, verse 4, the pay of the laborers who mowed your field, which has been withheld by you, cries out against you. Outcry those who do the harvesting. Reach the ears, Lord of Sabaoth. You've lived luxuriously on the earth. Led a life of want and pleasure. Fatten your hearts in a day of slaughter. Condemned and put to death the righteous man, and he doesn't resist. Be patient, therefore, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. Behold, the farmer waits for the precious produce of the soil, being patient about it until it gets the early and late rains. You too, be patient. Strengthen your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not complain, brethren, against one another, that you yourselves may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing right at the door. As an example, brethren, of suffering and patience, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we count those blessed who endured. You heard of the endurance of Job. You've seen the outcome of the Lord's dealings, that the Lord is full of compassion and is merciful. Our lesson is over for today. Because, brethren, whether you're living back then, whether you're living 10 years later, 100 years later, 1,000 years later, or 2,000 years later, that advice will stand so long as the earth does, that saints must expect tribulation and must be prepared to sacrifice everything they own and know and love in the service of their king. Jesus. Now, everybody please open to the book of Luke. We're going to read one last passage because it just coincidentally was part of our young adult class this morning. And so we're going to close with it today. See, again, full circle. James, 20-some years after Jesus rose from the dead and returned to heaven, we go back to Jesus himself in Luke 14, verse 26. If anyone comes to me, doesn't matter what time, doesn't matter what place, and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. Which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he's laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who observe it begin to ridicule him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Or what king, when he sets out to meet another king in battle, will not first sit down and take counsel whether he is strong enough with 10,000 to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000? Or else will the other so far away, since the delegation and ask terms of peace? So therefore, no one of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions. Therefore, salt is good, but if even salt has become tasteless, with what will it be seasoned? It is useless, either for the soil or for the manure pile. It is thrown out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Brethren, that is the end of the grimmer stuff in the book of James. But it may be for any one of you the beginning of your walk with Christ this morning, or a more faithful and determined and successful one from this day hence. Well, I spent a great deal of time this morning explaining to the kids about hyperbole and about grammatical expressions, and that the Lord is not asking you to hate your mom and dad, but to understand that you must choose between them and your Lord. And if there's a conflict between the two, pick the Lord. He was preparing them to understand their likely problems that lie ahead. Count the cost, and don't start if you can't finish. So, brethren, if you are not a Christian this morning, I, of course, am pleading with you to start, but count the cost. The Lord does, in fact, expect that you'll be more devoted to Him than your job, your family, or anything else that might appeal to you. He is expecting that in the context of Christianity, you will face a wide variety of problems and must be faithful to Him even to death. So if you're not yet a Christian, count the cost. It could be high, but recognize that it is well worth it. It's a bargain, brethren, over against an eternity in heaven. And if you are a Christian, but you recognize not very salty, not really very salty at all, it's never too late, you know, to rise up and say, you know what, I want to be a disciple, and I am therefore willing to carry my cross for Him. Whatever difficulties I have in my life, I will bear them. I will persevere through them. I will be perfected by them so that I can be perfect, complete, lacking in nothing, is the way James started his epistle about the difficulties saints would have. He's been elaborating for 5 chapters. If you're not a Christian this morning, please take the step to become one. If you're weak, if you're neglectful, if you're not very salty, then take steps today. Commit to the Lord, realize the cost is worth it, and serve Him as faithfully, as vigorously, as passionately, with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength, as you know how. And if we personally can help, let it be known. As together we stand and sing,